Interstellar has been out in theaters for a while, long enough that hopefully lots of you have had a chance to see it. The movie begins on a planet Earth that looks in some ways familiar, but a lot more dusty and desolate than the place we currently call home. Environmental disaster has struck, the population has dwindled, everyone's attention has turned to farming because food is scarce, and the crops, they're not looking so good. Under circumstances like these, where can humanity turn? If you have ever seen a movie, ever, the answer is obvious. We're going to space. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today's Central Standard is a multidisciplinary conversation about Interstellar. Stay with us.
I stand before you not as an expert, but as a concerned citizen.
That's not your average concerned citizen speaking. It's Leonardo DiCaprio. Though, like an ordinary citizen, he's worried about the planet. And he's not a scientist.
Every week we're seeing new and undeniable climate events, evidence that accelerated climate change is here right now. Droughts are intensifying, our oceans are acidifying, with methane plumes rising up from the ocean floor. We are seeing extreme weather events and the West Antarctic and Greenland ice sheets melting at unprecedented rates, decades ahead of scientific projections. None of this is rhetoric, and none of it is hysteria. It is fact. My friends, this body,
Leonardo
perhaps more
DiCaprio
than any other gathering
gave that
in human
speech in September. Just last week, the United Nations held a conference to create a global framework for addressing climate change. In the New York Times coverage of that conference, the paper proclaimed that at stake now is the difference between a newly unpleasant world and an uninhabitable one. I'm Gina Kaufman. As the movie Interstellar imagines a future where the Earth's ability to grow food has completely deteriorated, we're hosting a roundtable to find the overlap between the science of movies and actors and the science of, well, scientists. But first, let's check in on that UN conference on climate change with a local scientist who was there. He's a professor in the Department of Geography at Kansas State University. Bimal Pal, welcome to Central Standard.
Good morning.
What were some of the major themes that emerged from this United Nations conference in Lima, Peru?
The developing and developed countries, in total 196, they participated in this conference. And they agreed an accord which stated the reduction of climate emissions. And that will be discussed next year, COP conference, which will be held in Paris, France.
So climate emissions, were climate emissions something that you left with a lot of questions around?
Yes. In fact, what developing countries wanted, and they did not get it. They wanted to reduce the carbon emissions, double the current rate, but they did not get it. But ultimately, they signed the agreement.
So your primary interest as a researcher is in environmental hazards and disasters. What qualifies scientifically as a disaster, and how is a disaster different from a hazard?
Disaster, okay, let me tell about the hazard. Hazard is a potential extreme event. When hazard occurred, it becomes disaster. So disaster is the reality of the hazard. And there is another question. All disasters should not be considered as disasters. If it is not impact human, then it is not disaster. Say, for example, if there is a high magnitude earthquake in northern part of Alaska where there is no settlement, then it should not be considered as a disaster. Disaster must impact human.
So is climate change a hazard or a disaster?
That is a good question. So I think it is in between. In between in the sense that we believe that human activities have indeed intensified global warming. But many manifestations of such warning are not clearly evident to date. Climate change is a slow onset hazard, so it will take decades to see the visible impact, many visible impact of climate change.
So it'll take decades before we see that. How stable would you say is the environment in Kansas? When I hear news about the depletion of the Ogallala Aquifer, it makes me really nervous about sustaining the water supply necessary for growing food in Kansas long term. And that's just an example. Is that a reasonable level of fear I'm experiencing, or am I being alarmist?
No, I think you are right. Western Kansas has a risk, more risk of impact of global warming or climate change, as because one of the reasons for global warming is methane gas, a lot of methane gas produced in Western Kansas because of the feedlock.
Because of the feedlots?
Yes, yes. And also the Ogallala water is depleting, and that will be alarming.
What's at stake right now? Is the livability of the planet at stake?
To some extent, yes. But if we take the actions right now, then maybe we can save it for our next generations.
Do you worry about this when you go home at the end of the day? How scared are you?
I am scared, but not much for me, but for the next generations. As I said, it is a slow onset hazard or disaster, and all the manifestations will take time, maybe some decades. So I'm worried myself plus my next generation. In fact, next generation more than myself.
Bilal Paul, professor of geography at K-State, thanks so much for chatting with us this morning.
Thank you.
Okay, so I'm not sure whether to say that was reassuring or not. Maybe it's reassuring in the way of, like, things being kind of less bad than you thought, but still not good. I'll take shreds of optimism where I can find them, because the movie Interstellar freaked me out. Russ Simmons, film correspondent for Central Standard, could you start us off by sharing the premise of the plot? And let's steer clear of spoilers, at least for now.
Okay, I'll do the best I can. Essentially, what it is in the near future, there is a global climate disaster. The crops have developed a blight, and it's not only affecting the food supply, but also the atmosphere in negative ways. And it becomes quite clear that humanity cannot survive on this planet. And so efforts are made to see if there's a way to get us off the planet and to a more hospitable place somewhere out in the universe.
So from a plot perspective, and we won't give anything away right now, do you think that the plot holds together? Did you stay with it the whole time?
Yeah, I did. A lot of it is because of the care that director and writer Christopher Nolan has put into it, and Kip Thorne, who is the physicist who was the consultant on the film. And, you know, there's always a certain amount of suspension of disbelief that has to go along with any fantasy or science fiction film. But you're willing to do it, particularly in this film, because it is very intriguing.
Let's establish a couple of the characters real quick. The main character, I would say, is Matthew McConaughey's character, Cooper. What would you say about Cooper as a character?
Oh, he's kind of your typical gung-ho. He plays an astronaut.
A frustrated astronaut.
Yes, because he hasn't flown in a while simply because of the changes in economics. And as a matter of fact, one of the plot elements in the film is that people don't even believe there was a space program that was all supposedly faked and that the moon landing was faked. So they don't put stock in science very much. And so there is some kind of sly commentary on people who are climate deniers because, they say, well, they don't put very much stock in science.
So, and he's working as a farmer in his frustrated astronaut state.
Correct. And without giving too much away, he becomes involved with some other people in an attempt to see if we can rocket out into space as a species and survive.
And Anne Hathaway comes into play in this movie. What would you say about her character?
She's I wish I could say that she was an atypical female, you know, part, but unfortunately, I think she is kind of typical. She's subservient in some ways to his character, but you don't really know what her motives are until much later in the film. So if we're not going to give spoilers, it's kind of hard to talk about.
Right. And so what would you say from a craft perspective? How does the movie hold up from a craft perspective?
It's brilliant. The production values are tremendous. And if you're going to go see this movie, try to see it in IMAX. And it's really visually stunning. And the way that they've visualized some things that no one has ever seen is very creative, and particularly the black hole. Supposedly, according to the experts, that probably is what it would look like if you ever saw one.
Central Standard is off to a break, but when we return, our roundtable discussion will begin. An astrophysicist and science fiction expert will join our film critic, and you can too. Call 816-235-2888 with the questions Interstellar raised for you. We'll see if we can't get them answered. I'm Gina Kaufman. And we're back. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today's show is a real treat. For me, and I hope for you, we're convening a roundtable of experts from a variety of disciplines to talk about the movie Interstellar. We welcome your reviews as well. Call 816-235-2888 if you want to chime in. I'd like to reintroduce film critic Russ Simmons. Hi, Russ.
Hi.
Also joining us this morning is astrophysicist Gregory Rudnick. He's with us from KU, and he knows all about time and space and gravity and stuff like that. Right, Gregory?
Yeah, that's right. I hope.
So how did you get into the study of astrophysics? I imagine that somewhere in your past, before you were an academic who specialized in the field, you were a boy who saw a movie or two about space. Am I right?
Well, yeah. I mean, Star Wars. But that wasn't, I think, I really wanted to be an astronaut, funny enough. And I started studying astronomy a little bit in high school on the side. And in college, I did both physics and astronomy and tried to search for which one kind of fit me better. But in the end, I kept getting pulled back toward astronomy. And then I went to graduate school, and kind of the rest is history.
So what is a day in the life of a Kansas-based astrophysicist?
Well, I teach a class. I do research, and my research usually involves working with students, people who have already – so these are both undergraduate and graduate students working on different projects. I work in kind of large national and international collaborations doing kind of big astrophysical projects with telescopes. I do KU.
What's an example of a big astrophysical project?
So, for example, I'm involved in a project right now where we're using these two big 8-meter diameter mirror telescopes, one in Chile, one in Hawaii, to study galaxy clusters when the universe was about a half to a third of its current age. So we're actually using the fact that light travels at a fixed speed to look back in time. So we can observe the universe when it was much younger than today.
You're freaking me out.
I mean, this you opened up a can of worms. I mean, if we could talk. It's related to the movie and the fact that time in some ways is relative, and we can use certain facets of the universe to allow us to look back in time. In fact, we have no choice in some respect. Whenever we look at things far away, we're looking at things as they appeared in the past. And so I get to look at literally snapshots of the way the universe looked when it was only a few billion years old. The universe right now is 13.7 billion years old. We know that number really accurately, surprisingly. And so we can study the way the universe has evolved by really looking back and seeing how it looked like at earlier times.
I'll let go of your projects in just a second, but I am curious, what is a galaxy cluster?
A galaxy cluster is a group of galaxies. So a galaxy is a group of stars that are held together by their own gravity. You can have something like 100 billion stars. So that's a one with 11 zeros after it, and that's a lot. And galaxies can move around each other, being pulled to each other by their own gravity. And then if you get hundreds or thousands of those together in one spot, we call it a galaxy cluster. It's kind of like an urban environment in a universal sense.
Well, okay. So you look back in time at galaxy clusters as an astrophysicist. I think that your credibility in that realm is clearly established. Let's get your review of the movie Interstellar. We'll get a more in-depth review in just a minute, but for now, just very basically, did you like Interstellar? Give us the quick and dirty version of your review.
I liked Interstellar. I thought it was a good movie. I was happy that I didn't have to ignore physics to watch the movie. There was nothing in the movie that broke physical laws. There was some really great creative stretching of the imagination, but nothing that made me think, wait a minute, that just goes against what we know.
I'm amazed by that because when I, as a non-astrophysicist watching this movie, I felt like there were a lot of moments where a lot of information was given really fast, and it felt like almost a deliberate attempt to sound credible and confuse me.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of information because it's kind of complicated. General relativity, which plays a big role in the movie, is complicated, but they did an accurate job talking about what we know about it, and the stuff that they kind of made up for good movie making wasn't something that went against anything we know. It was just kind of a stretch of the stuff that we're not quite sure about.
Well, and, go on.
No, so that was good. And I liked the movie too. It was an interesting plot, kind of nice character development at some level. I liked it.
Cool. Well, we've got one more guest to introduce this morning before we really dive in. Chris McKitterick is with us from the studios of Kansas Public Radio in Lawrence. He's the director of the Gunn Center for the Study of Science Fiction at KU. Hi, Chris.
Morning, Gina.
So I don't think a lot of people know that KU has a center for the study of science fiction. What do you guys do over there?
Well, we do a ton of things. James Gunn established the center back in the 70s sort of as an umbrella for all the science fiction programs he had going on here. That would be courses, writing workshops, literature courses. There's a conference where we present award winners for best novel, science fiction novel, and best short science fiction in the summer. That's the Campbell and the Sturgeon Awards. We have a collection of rare books and manuscript, a lot of manuscript items and papers and so forth at the Spencer Research Library here. We have talks. We have a bunch of things.
Well, why – and I don't mean this to sound contrary at all, but why does science fiction matter enough to merit its own center for in-depth study at a research university? What can understanding science fiction do for us?
Well, you know, I'm glad you asked that because science fiction, I think what Interstellar does is what science fiction does really well. Darko Suvin described science fiction as the literature of cognitive estrangement. That is that it's the interaction of estrangement, something unusual, something different than what we're familiar with, and cognition. That is something to get us thinking, and also presenting information that we can willingly suspend our disbelief about whatever is different, the othering that's going on inside of the show or the story or the novel.
Okay, so cognitive estrangement. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about the estrangement piece of it because different science fiction, it seems to me, takes us to a universe that is in some cases very similar to ours and just a little bit different, a little bit strange, and in some cases like unrecognizable strange. Where would you say Interstellar fits on that science fiction spectrum?
Well, you know, Interstellar provides two really big differences. One is that it's very mundane and very everyday. We see people putting covers over water so the dust, the ever-present dust, doesn't get into things. We see daily life in a very slow apocalypse. And at the same time, we see this fantastic cosmological science fiction. We see black holes and wormholes and alien galaxies and things. And it's astounding bringing those two together in ways that science fiction can do at its very best.
What is your history as a science fiction fan? It's hard for me to imagine that in your position you didn't start as a fan.
I think most people who are passionate about whatever they do start as a fan of whatever it was, just like I'm sure Gregory was a fan of astrophysics. But yeah, when I was young, I started reading a lot of nonfiction. A lot of my favorite readings were astronomy. I started studying astronomy in high school. I was teaching directed study astronomy classes there. I went to college for astrophysics, discovered that was much less my interest than the observational aspects of astronomy and the theory of astronomy. And that led me to just embracing my original passion, that is writing and science fiction.
I came to KU to study with
James Gunn in 1992 and volunteered with him every summer for years and years until I came back to KU to teach full time in 2002.
Where would you put Interstellar as far as its relationship to sort of classical science fiction books or movies or just works of classical science fiction, really celebrated stuff?
You know, I went to watch this again last night when I heard I was going to be doing this morning, and I brought a notebook with me. I took 23 pages of notes while the movie was going.
What are you going to do with those notes?
Well, you know, I've already started putting together a paper, actually. But a lot of the things that I hadn't noticed the first time, because I was just so wrapped up in the heart of that movie, I was more thinking about it this time. And of course, Kubrick and Clark's 2001 A Space Odyssey, so many references throughout the film and reactions against that. And I can say more about that later. But also Isaac Asimov's robot stories and his laws of robotics, Borges's Library of Babel, the story about, well, I won't get into it without giving any spoilers. there's a touchstone story from the 50s called The Cold Equations about how space is dangerous and unforgiving. Just good science throughout. It felt to me like a blend of a lot of the different movements in science fiction over the years updated for a modern time.
Okay, now we're going to get more in-depth with the movie discussion. So if you haven't seen it and planned to, this is when you need to be forewarned. We'll do our best as a group to avoid spoilers when we don't need them or to alert you if the discussion is about to get into that territory. But we can't be held responsible for what happens from here on out in that respect. Chris, you were just saying some of the things that really causes Interstellar to hold up in the whole realm of science fiction. Do you have criticisms of Interstellar?
Well, you know, it's the way I watch a film is a little different than I'm sure Russ does, because I'm a writer. I can criticize a script a lot more easily than I can criticize an entire movie that involves hundreds or thousands of people. For me, at first I was wondering if all of the physics holds up, and I did my research, and boy, almost all of it does, and I'm sure we'll hear more about that. It felt a little bit some of the early things where we hear Murph talking about the ghosts.
And Murph, that's the daughter of the Cooper character we heard about, the frustrated astronomer who is a farmer who is going to find a way to save Earth by save humanity. Go on.
Right. And Murph, you know, in a lot of ways really is the hero of the movie. But so much of what was happening when I first saw it, I thought, oh, this is going to be really corny. And so I sort of had my shields up for that. But rewatching it, because I knew what was going on with that, I had much more, I was much more forgiving of what I felt what could have been really corny. And I think that it actually has very important messages.
From your perspective, what is the message of the film and how artfully is that message communicated?
Oh, well, it has so many different messages, especially in the beginning. But I think toward the end, the message comes down to that central theme about love, about Amelia Brand, Dr. Brand, later in the movie says that
played by Anne Hathaway.
Love isn't something. What's that?
Oh, played by Anne Hathaway.
Exactly right. Fantastic job, by the way. She says that love is not something that we invented. It's observable. It's powerful. It has to mean something. That love is the one thing that we're capable of perceiving that transcends dimensions of time and space. And everything else revolves around that one speech, I think.
Gregory Rudnick, you are an astrophysicist, so tell me, we've heard that Interstellar is really a tour de force when viewed through the lens of science fiction, and we've heard that it holds up pretty well through the lens of science fact. What are your thoughts about science fiction and its obligation to science fact?
Well, I think that science fiction can really stretch the limits of what we know, move way beyond it, and I think some science fiction that sticks very close to what we know and adds an element of mysterious. And 2001, for example, was a perfect example of that. Most everything they were talking about was very realistic except the part at the end. I don't want to spoil that in case somebody still hasn't seen it. But I think that stuff that explores the mix of how we are on Earth today and what our near-term future might be, and then allowing us to use what we know about science and some imagination to explore how we can mix the fantastical with the very real and sometimes scary. I think science fiction is the genre that lets us explore that. It's not clear how else you would do it, how else you would take normal, everyday situations on Earth, things that very likely could happen, and link it to intergalactic travel, black holes. So, sorry, that was a spoiler.
Russ, what do you think?
Well, you know, all really good science fiction is not about the future. It's not about it's about us and it's about now and how that relates to us. And I think that given the fact that this movie really does touch on the fact that we are headed down a dark path environmentally is probably its greatest strength in that it brings up that concern and says, hey, wait a minute, we need to think about this so we don't get into that situation down the road.
Let's talk. We've got a caller at 816-235-2888. Knut has called us from Germany. Hi, Knut.
Hello, everyone.
Thanks for listening. Tell us, what do you want to know from us, or do you have a review to share?
I think it's a very interesting discussion so far, and the question I basically have is, this is a science fiction movie. The dangers that I describe, not in the specific way they're happening, but you know, in general, are real. Climate change is something that we see. So, without spoilers again, would it in generally be physically possible to really lift a substantial fraction of the population into space? You know, could we have an escape into, say, some space station or to Moon or Mars, etc., as is an idea? Is that possible? Maybe that's a question to the astrophysicist.
Yeah, Greg, if things get really bad here, of course, I think most of us would like to preserve Earth if we can. But say we can't, can we all just skedaddle?
We don't know how to do that, and I don't see any real way to do that. And that was actually a major premise of the movie. So am I allowed to give a little bit of a spoiler now?
Here we go.
All righty. So one of the biggest things in the movie was, how are we going to do this? And there were kind of two options. And the one option that Knut really references is, could we get a large number of people off? And the movie kind of had this ongoing quest, this parallel quest. On one hand, the astronauts were going to another galaxy to try and find places to live. And on Earth, there was this other quest that was, while you're doing that, we're going to figure out how to get everybody off the Earth. And we're going to do that by arriving at some new understanding of gravity that we haven't come to before.
Why is a new understanding of gravity necessary to get people off the Earth? Because if this handful of scientists can leave, why can't everyone do it in just the same way?
Well, the handful of scientists were able to leave because they went up on a conventional rocket ship that was fueled by chemicals that burned. And then they went to a wormhole, a gate through time and space that was put there by some other beings that were referred to as they, right? Nobody really knew who they were. But that didn't provide a way to get the people physically off the Earth. And so Michael Caine's character, the other Dr. Brandt, was trying to find a way to control gravity so that you wouldn't have to burn chemicals, which is pretty inefficient actually, to get people up there. You could literally change gravity and just move them up to space. And once you can get past that barrier, it becomes possible. We have no idea how to do that. And they didn't in the movie either. It was this ongoing quest through the movie.
So what they don't know is what we don't know. And so we don't know.
Right.
Okay. But you mentioned that there are three possibilities. And so maybe if you could lay out
Two
possibilities.
And the other possibility was, you just bring up a bunch of embryos and you have a small group of astronauts basically grow the embryos, test tube babies. You develop a small population. I think in the movie they said you start off with 10. And then those people, as they naturally mature, would care for the next generation and the next generation. And the real trick is to maintain genetic diversity so that you don't have mutations by lots of interbreeding. So if you get a large enough and diverse enough population with genetics very carefully chosen, you can presumably then create a population with enough diversity to actually take our species off the planet without actually taking many living people off the planet.
So it's sort of like giving up on humanity in the present to save humanity in the future, which is part of the emotional conundrum of the film. Right, Russ?
Absolutely. And you know what? Incidentally, just to interject one other point, I was listening to Neil deGrasse Tyson, the astrophysicist, making some observations about this. And when he talks about saving the planet, he said, technologically speaking, it would be a lot easier task to save the planet than it would be to get the people off the planet. And so he said that was one of his major problems with the basic overall plot of Interstellar. Much easier to fix the planet than get off of it.
Chris McKitterick, what are your thoughts on this?
You know, one thing that it reminded me of just hearing this, well, a couple of things, is one that science fiction is a laboratory for experimenting with ideas. Those are the like the plan A and B that Greg mentioned. There are two ways to save the human species. One is to just give up and start fresh somewhere else, and the other is to move everybody else. But then there's the notion that something that H.G. Wells had said, one of the science fiction's early founders, and that was that mankind was born here on Earth, that it was never meant to die here. That's Coop. The shell is broken too soon. Our crib, there is nothing to be done but make a bad omelet. That's H.G. Wells.
So the idea that we're not meant to die here, flesh that out.
So the notion that we are sort of imprisoned on a single planet is I think part of what this is getting at. If some major catastrophe comes along, and what I love about this movie is the catastrophe is something that we bring about ourselves. This is everything you can see that's going on. Sure, the blight is organic, but this is the thing that's destroying crops around the world. But this overdependence on monocrops, just like the potatoes in Ireland or the wheat in the Dust Bowl, single crops will die if you rely on them. We saw this happen with bananas, right? And we're seeing all kinds of problems happening with individual crops like that. But if we put all of our eggs into one basket, we drop that basket and we're all dead.
Okay.
There's another real thing about this, a reality to this is that, we could have catastrophes that could endanger the whole planet. We could have asteroid impacts, right? So there are people really thinking hard about what's the best way to mitigate the impact on our species of these hazards, right?
And people are thinking about this in the field of astrophysics?
Yeah, yeah. People, one of the big drives for settling other planets is the idea that we need to get off the one planet that can support us and find other ways to ensure the survivability of our species.
So that we're not just like the dinosaurs.
Right.
Okay.
Now, Greg, one of your colleagues is working on that, right?
Adrian Malott.
Yes.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Oh, he studies the effects on life of astrophysical events. So among those could be comets or asteroids hitting the Earth. What would the effects on life be? Or if a star nearby were to blow up, how would that change our atmosphere? Could it change the atmospheric chemistry such that more ultraviolet light got through from the sun and cancer rates skyrocketed? So just thinking about these different types of scenarios, not so much because we can stop a star from exploding, partially they just understand in general how life evolves in the universe and what kind of factors you have to consider. But there's also a threat avoidance component to his research as well.
Okay, so I've got a clip from the movie that I'm going to set up real quick. Part of the dystopian future that's imagined here on Earth includes a certain attitude toward science, and we've kind of referenced that. It's also an attitude toward progress and optimism, which are all part of a very American idea of what space exploration is all about. In this world where everyone's struggling just to grow enough food to eat, the entire history of science and space exploration has become suspect. That's something that we learned during a parent-teacher conference at school. Cooper, who's had to shelve his dreams of going to space in order to be a farmer, is talking in this clip to his daughter's teacher. Let's give it a listen.
Murph is a great kid. She's really bright, but she's been having a little trouble lately. She brought this in to show the other students the section on the lunar landings.
Yeah, it's one of my old textbooks. She always loved the pictures.
It's an old federal textbook. We've replaced them with the corrected versions.
Corrected?
Explaining how the Apollo missions were faked to bankrupt the Soviet Union.
You don't believe we went to the moon?
I believe it was a brilliant piece of propaganda that the Soviets bankrupted themselves, pouring resources into rockets and other useless machines.
Useless machines?
And if we don't want a repeat of the excess and wastefulness of the 20th century, then we need to teach our kids about this planet, not tales of leaving it.
You know, one of those useless machines they used to make was called an MRI. And if we had any of those left, the doctors would have been able to find the cyst in my wife's brain before she died instead of afterwards. And then she'd have been the one sitting there listening to this instead of me, which had been a good thing because she was always the calmer one.
So we get a very, not only a clear sense of the attitude towards science in this world, but also to our protagonist's reaction to it. Russ, what did you think of this scene?
Actually, it's one of the clearer scenes in the film. You know, just stepping back and looking at the movie from the film critic's perspective, and Greg and I were talking about this earlier, is that one of the big problems that I had was with the soundtrack, And so much of the dialogue was obscured by either the music or things happening, and, you know, explosions and other sound effects. And I wanted to learn about what the premise was. I wanted to learn a little bit more about the physics to make this all palatable, because a movie has to be true to its own reality. It can stretch reality, but it has to be true to the established facts that it has created for itself.
So like you make up your own rules, but then you've got to follow
them. You've got to stick to those rules, right. And so I wanted to hear the rules. But since all that was obscured, I had a really hard time with the rules.
So this scene, though, had particular clarity for
yes.
you. And it seems like part of what's really carefully established very early on in this movie is the relationship between Cooper and his daughter Murphy, named after Murphy's Law. Can you talk about that relationship now that the spoiler gloves are off, so to speak?
Okay. Well, Murph is, you know, the kind of the chip off the old block of Cooper, and she is the scientist, and she at one point in the film is getting these strange messages that seem to be binary code, and it's she doesn't know who's giving her these messages. It's coming from somewhere. And it's telling her that she has to insist that her father not leave, go on this rocket ship to find the other planets out there. There's someone sending her a message. And that relationship, father and daughter relationship, is what really carries the whole film. Later on, she grows up. She turns into Jessica Chastain. And then much later, it's Ellen Burstyn on her deathbed. But it's the father-daughter relationship that's the crux of the movie.
And there are two father-daughter relationships in this movie. There's also the elder Dr. Brand, who's frantically trying to figure out an equation that will get the people off the Earth to be saved. And then there's the younger Dr. Brand, who goes up in this spaceship with Matthew McConaughey. Mm-hmm. So can we talk about – I felt like there was an attempt to establish some kind of parallel, and it felt a little bit unfulfilled to me.
Interesting. You know, but she – you know, you don't learn this till later, but Anne Hathaway's character, the daughter of – the doctor who's the head of the scientific program to send off this rocket, she has ulterior motives. And I don't know if we want to get into that, but the reason that she's going up there may not be the same reason that her father has sent her there. And it turns out that he was not being honest with everyone.
Well, let's discuss this ulterior motive shortly, but I want to take a call quickly from Laura in Warrensburg. Hi, Laura.
Hi. I have a question about the very end.
Okay, so we're going to talk about the end.
I don't want to give away a spoiler. But I think that there was a stress between going and staying, if you know what I mean.
So the astronaut has the choice to go and participate in this project or...
No, Murphy. Murphy has the binary code. We talked about that before. But she realizes what the code is saying. So that, to me, goes back to Neil deGrasse Tyson and the possibility that the Earth could reverse its global warming and go back to being a habitable location. Can that be true?
Okay, I think we've got to tease a little bit of this out. So the young girl receives a message in binary code in her bedroom. It has to do with books falling off shelves, dust falling in patterns. She interprets this message. It's what sort of catapults a lot of this plot, where her father is perhaps going to end up trying to save humanity, but also leaving her behind. And then the tension becomes... stay or go? Do we try to save the Earth or do we try to explore other planets?
I'm trying to understand, are you implying that if you could go back in time and send signals, why couldn't you just go back farther and avert the catastrophe in the first place? Is that kind of what you're...
No. I'm there in the present where the crops are gone and it's the new Dust Bowl and the worldwide experience is beyond living. So, but at the end, to me, it gave me an insight that there was possibly a way to reverse global warming, because she got the information today.
Yeah, there was this conversation between her and her father where she keeps early on in the movie where she keeps saying stay, stay, stay. Does anyone have a response to Laura about this question of staying or going, and was there a moment where this was reversible? What about you, Chris McKitterick, from a science fiction analysis point of view?
Well, no, there are a couple things going on there. One, the stay, this is Coop having trouble letting go at a point when I'm not going to describe it in any detail because you all have to see this. But he's trying to stop himself. He's trying to change the past, even though he knows he cannot change the past. In fact, there's a line there that the they didn't bring us here to change the past. That, in fact, the only way that we're going to get past this dystopian world is that if everybody cooperates, if we stop, you know, BSing each other, putting our own personal needs and desires and fears ahead of the rest of the species and this mission, by only cooperating and collaborating can we change the future. We cannot change the past. All we can do is live with that and try to be the best possible people. And I love that in this movie that we have scientists as heroes, and even when we have bad scientists, it's not because he's a bad scientist, it's because he's a bad person.
And I think, well, Central Standard's off to one last break. We'll get right back to this conversation about Interstellar with a film critic, an astrophysicist, and a science fiction researcher. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. And we're back. I'm Gina Kaufman, and my guests this morning are astrophysicist Greg Rudnick, science fiction researcher Chris McKitterick, and movie critic Russ Simmons. This is a Central Standard roundtable all about the movie Interstellar. We were just talking before we went to break about this whole idea of trying to save humanity as a species and trying to save yourself as an individual. And I think one of the big questions in this movie is whether human beings are capable of not thinking about themselves as individuals, of not placing a premium on their own personal survival. Chris, would you pick back up where you left off on that?
Oh, sure. Well, that's exactly what I was going to go with that, actually. That the theme of love, and that, you know, you asked me before, what was its central theme? Well, there's several central themes, but the main central theme is about what love can do. But especially it's that love for the future generations here embodied in the children and grandchildren that we get to see. And if we are only brave and we carry hope and love for the future, that's the only way to be able to stop a dystopia like this. And I think that the reason today's most relevant and most popular art is dystopian is that one of the things that art does is reflect our fears and nightmares about the future. But science fiction also dramatizes the hopes and dreams of a technological and knowledgeable society. And I think that, you know, Coop is just like the perfect science fictional hero.
Say more about that.
Okay, well, he's somebody who operates out of rationality and scientific thought, that is, problem solving. He also is somebody who trusts. In fact, at one point, one of the robots, and we haven't had a chance to talk about them at all, but I think they're fantastic. But the robot doesn't trust humans as much as this main character does because he loves us. But the people that he ends up putting most of his trust in are the people who are the right ones to put his trust in. And we get to see why that is. It's not just that they're smarter, not just that they're more capable or braver or that they carry more love with them. It's that they're all those things and that they're not stupidly self-sacrificial, but that they're not self-centered.
There's a character played by Matt Damon, and to even bring him up is in some sense its own spoiler, but he is kind of a scientist gone wrong. And his main struggle is this thing where he isn't able to abandon his own self-interest. But he talks about that in the movie, and he kind of alerts us to the other character's failure to factor the human survival instinct into their interpretation of data and into their interpretation of his data in particular. And I wonder what our scientist thinks about this. Do you have to factor human fallibility into data generated by humans?
Yes. I mean, we are people, and we try and be as objective as we can. And in fact, much of the way that science is conducted, I think the infrastructure around how we produce scientific results and interpret them takes that – has to take that into account, and does to some extent. It's why you have peer review of journals, for example, that you can't just publish something from data you have. Other people have to look at it, because we recognize that people take these data and there could be completely benign reasons why you could be wrong, like you just made a mistake. There could also be, you know, unfortunately – in limited circumstances, there could be people who do stuff because they have egos, because they have ulterior motives. So it's not that science is purely cold and dispassionate and that we're all robots, although the robots in this movie were quite emotional.
There are other planets portrayed in this movie, and they are fantastic cinematic worlds. Russ, I wonder if you can talk from a film critic's perspective about these other worlds, and maybe we'll get a little insight into the scientific stuff there too.
Well, one is a planet that they had thought would be habitable that is covered with roiling oceans and tides, which my understanding that this planet would not have been light, being as close to the black hole as it was, that there wouldn't have — the light would have been sucked away and you wouldn't have been able to see it. Is that incorrect?
Yeah, that's not the light doesn't get sucked away. It's just if light happens to go into the black hole, it never gets out. Mm-hmm. But there was a lot of hot gas around the black hole, and that hot gas could be bright enough to just provide the light. It would be different than what we had on Earth. So, you know, the exact conditions are hard to know just from the movie. I thought the tides were really interesting, these huge tidal waves, because when you have —
yeah, it was like vertical water that
moved. It was a big wave that moved. That's what tides are. I mean, tides are big waves that move around the Earth, and they hit us twice a day. You just have to think about a big wave moving around the Earth, and it maybe only is a few feet high. And this was the extreme version, but this was also next to a gargantuan black hole. And so that was a really interesting twist on a phenomenon that anybody who lives on the coast would see twice a day.
Mm-hmm. But just an exaggerated and really menacing version.
Yes.
And the other planet is a sort of an ice planet, equally inhospitable, but perhaps a little bit more habitable than the water planet. But there also had a question about the ice clouds. Is that something that holds up physically?
Well, I think the idea was it was so cold for whatever reason. Like, we don't know how that planet was 100 million years ago. But at the time, we look at it, it's so cold that whatever atmosphere it had froze out. Now, whether or not you'd have light, fluffy, frozen clouds, I don't know. I mean, we've never been to a planet like that. I think having the entire atmosphere freeze out isn't inconceivable. I mean, if the planet gets cold enough, maybe before there was this big black hole, there may have been stars in this system and they could have kept this planet warm. But as those stars died, when the black hole finally formed, that planet may have been far enough away that it was too cold then for the atmosphere to stay vapor, and then a large fraction of it, the water part of it at least, froze out, and the ammonia left over, which is why the atmosphere has so much ammonia in it.
Well, wouldn't the gravity have pulled those ice clouds down then to the planet?
Well, they may have been. I think the idea was that the atmosphere had built up on whatever surface there was, or if it was a gas giant like Jupiter, for example. Jupiter has no atmosphere. I mean, it has an atmosphere. It has no solid surface. If all that atmosphere freezes, then you get a solid surface that's made out of the atmosphere. Matt Damon made this claim, spoiler. well, it's not really that big of a spoiler, that if you go down far enough, you actually get down to some solid surface. And whether or not you have that or not depends. I mean, there could be infinite variety when it comes to how planets work. So this was one not implausible branch of that.
You are surprisingly game for fictional planets.
Oh, I think we're forced to be. I mean, we now have literally over 1,000 planets that we know of around other stars. Planets around other stars are no longer science fiction. They are a complete reality. We have things that are slightly larger than the mass of the Earth around other stars that we've now been able to study. Well, we don't really study them. We know they're there, but studying them is still something we're working on. We have planets that are at the distance from their star that they could have liquid water on the surface. And we're finding things all the time that we don't expect. Many of the earliest, I'll call them extrasolar systems that we found, and there are stars with multiple planets around them, look completely different from ours. All the really big planets like Jupiter aren't very, very far away from the sun. They're extremely close to the sun, closer than Mercury even. And we didn't know how those even could form. So I think our knowledge about how planets form and what kind of planets there are is changing day to day. So I think there's a lot of room for cool speculation.
So that sounds like your overall review of Interstellar is yes?
Sure. Okay. If you believe in wormholes.
That's all the time we have for today's show. Thanks for being a part of Central Standard's movie coverage. Russ Simmons, Central Standard's film correspondent. It's been a pleasure, as always.
Thanks for having me.
Greg Rednick, come back anytime. I really like saying there's an astrophysicist in the room.
I like being the astrophysicist, so thanks.
And Chris McKitterick, we're all looking forward to that scholarly paper you plan to write on Interstellar. Hope this was helpful.
Oh, thanks a bunch. This was great.
Chris McKitterick is the director of the Gunn Center for the Study of Science Fiction at KU, and he's been with us thanks to the generosity and assistance of the fine people at Kansas Public Radio. Tomorrow, in a world of international news, we're going to do a year-in-review zooming in on neighborhoods and tight-knit communities within our own city. 2014 Hyperlocal. Join us for that. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.